This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Street Theater, 26th and Southeast Clinton in Portland. Tickets are available now at Brown Paper Tickets. Seating is limited. 100% of ticket sales go to KBOO for this benefit spectacular. See events under the KBOO website for February 14th, Valentine's Day. See you there.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, hundreds of Oregonians gather in Northwest Portland to oppose Nestle's proposal to bottle Columbia River Gorge water.
The unsealing of an affidavit in the Pacific Northwest grand jury case reveals government targeting of anarchists.
Gay rights activists plan a protest tomorrow against a bakery in Gresham accused of discrimination against gays, bisexuals, and transgender customers.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 8th, 2013. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterland. A Gresham bakery that's become a flashpoint for the issue of gay rights will be the site of a protest tomorrow at noon. The bakery refused to make a wedding cake for a lesbian couple last week, citing religious freedom. According to Oregon state law, businesses are not allowed to discriminate on the basis of race, gender, or sexual orientation. Jeff Manning with the Oregon Department of Justice spoke with KBOO about the case.
Well, right now, you know, a lot of people are saying that the DOJ is investigating. That is going too far at this point. We're reviewing the complaint, and that's what we do in any of these cases. The first thing we do is we go to the target of the complaint, in this case the bakery, and we ask them for their take on the events, and we're still waiting for their response. And at that point, we would decide whether it merits going forward. And again, there's this sort of jurisdictional uncertainty here as to who's going to pursue this case, if anybody.
That was KBOO's Jenka Soderberg. She also managed to speak with Robert Cochran, who is helping to organize tomorrow's protest. Let me restate that. That was actually Jeff Manning in an interview with Jenka Soderberg. Now we have Jenka speaking with Robert Cochran, who is helping to organize tomorrow's protest.
What led you to make that decision to organize a protest?
Well, you know, I'm sort of an activist by nature. For the last couple of years, I've been a canvasser and a political organizer for a variety of organizations. I happened to have a few days of free time, and when I read about this story, it really just infuriated me that the business was so blatant. When I saw a reporter recently ask them in the original Huffington Post story, that if they knew that they broke the law, and the business owner said, yeah, I know we broke the law, and, you know, we don't care. He said that they would rather close down their business than make a cake for a lesbian couple for a wedding. And, you know, that kind of blatant defiance of the law and slap to the face of all that we've worked so hard for over the last few decades for equal rights was just something that I could not allow to happen. And so I decided to take action. So I put together a Facebook, event, organizing a protest, sent it out to a few of my friends. And now there are over 1,000 of these invitations have gone out on Facebook. And so far, the response has been great.
Some business owners say they have a right to refuse business to anyone, or refuse service to anyone. And is that actually legal in Oregon?
Well, business owners certainly do retain the right to refuse service to anyone, but when that refusal of service is solely based on someone's sexual orientation or their race or their gender, for example, that is a crime under Oregon law. These people were not gave no other reason for their refusal of service other than the fact that it was a lesbian couple that was getting married. And the website on the for Sweet Cake says that they make cakes for all occasions. And so Oregon law says that if you are doing business with the general public, that you are not allowed to discriminate.
Some people say that by holding a protest or continuing to target this business that you're giving them unnecessary publicity. What's your response to that?
I can understand that. And the fact is a lot of people have talked about boycotting the business. But, you know, for every one person that doesn't buy a cake from, I mean, who's to say that they would have bought a cake from Sweet Cakes anyway? You know, the business owners are bragging about how they are getting support anyway from their business. And, you know, I think that this should be publicized. If they are getting publicity out of this and their name should be brought before the public. We're not advertising their business saying, gee, what great cakes they make. We're bringing awareness to the public that when business owners blatantly discriminate like this, there are going to be consequences. And you can't just get away with that without people noticing and making a fuss about it.
Well, thanks very much. Again, I've been speaking with Rob Cochran. He's organizing a protest tomorrow, Saturday, February 9th at noon at the Sweet Cakes Bakery in Gresham. That's 44 Northeast Division in Gresham. That's a bakery that refused to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
A local gay and lesbian community center has canceled a proposed dialogue on racism in the gay community after members of minority communities say they were excluded from the planning and tokenized. The Q Center decided to organize the gathering after a local gay bar came under fire for scheduling a Texas-based comedian who performs in blackface. The bar on North Lombard Street, the Eagle, caters mainly to gay men in the leather community. The owner ended up canceling a performance by comedian Chuck Nipp after protests from customers and others in the queer community. Nipp performs in blackface as the character Shirley Q. Licker. He describes the character as, quote, an inarticulate black welfare mother with 19 children, unquote. The Eagle has a reputation of being hostile to women, a reputation which its new owner hoped to change when he took over last year. Now the bar has gained a reputation of being racist and is still seen as hostile to women.
Washington State's Senate unanimously approved a measure today that removes male-dominated language from the state's laws. The bill is expected to pass easily through the Washington House of Representatives, its next step. If signed into law, it would change words in the state code such as freshman or watchman to gender-neutral terms. Florida and Minnesota have already made similar changes to their laws, and about half of all U.S. states have begun moving towards such revisions.
Despite objections from organic farmers, the state of Oregon has announced that canola, including genetically modified strains, will be allowed to be grown in the Willamette Valley. Yesterday, the State Department of Agriculture issued a new rule allowing up to 2,500 acres of canola crops. Family farmers in the valley fear that genetically modified canola pollen will contaminate their organic products and ruin their crops. Agricultural officials say the new rules will still exclude canola from certain areas, but will allow large-scale farming of the grain.
Today, hundreds of Oregonians stood together to say no to the Nestle proposal to bottle public water in the scenic Columbia River Gorge. At the same time, Nestle is busy in Salem trying to convince our elected leaders that taking public water from the threatened salmon habitat is good for Oregon. KBOO's Joe Meyer covered the action at Lower McClay Park in northwest Portland and filed this report.
The Swiss multinational Nestle is the largest food company in the world and has applied for permits to extract 100 million gallons a year of our pristine Bull Run water and resell it in plastic bottles at a 1,500% markup. Opponents say that taking this much public water will harm critical habitat for threatened salmon. They also decry the lack of public input. I attended the aerial art mob at Lower McClay Park earlier today and captured the vox pop.
I just think it's important to kind of raise people's awareness because a lot of people don't understand what goes into it. They think, oh, it's just, you know, a bottle of water here and there. It's not a real big deal.
Yeah.
But it's lots and lots of really good water. We have spring water, and people come out to our house because it tastes so good and get some of our water. And to have that all be bottled and processed and shipped somewhere else and not where, you know, it belongs in the ground for everyone to, you know, enjoy and use there, that kind of seems wrong to me. It affects the world.
There's no stopping this company. I mean, they don't stop when they, you know, other people start running out. They don't stop there. They'll keep taking it and taking it. It's the same company that back in the 70s was giving out breast milk till the people's memories dried up. I mean, when women couldn't make their own milk, they were hooked on Nestle. That's what they want. They want our water to dry up, and then they can sell it back to us.
It's gross.
Huge amount.
Yeah, it's just gross.
A huge amount of money compared to what we pay for healthy water. They want plastic infused water to be sold in the convenience store. It just doesn't make sense.
Okay, so you know how there's the Nesquik bunny? Oh, you guys remember those commercials where he drinks out of this huge straw and his ears get all tangled up, and then the chocolate milk full of high fructose corn syrup and other gross stuff drains to the bottom? That's what he's going to do to our water tables.
Corporations can buy off our Congress, the states and the whole country too. Corporations like Nestle will rob us of resources needed by me and you.
Today, we had hundreds of people take action against Nestle's plans to bottle our public water in the Columbia River Gorge. We started out this morning at 7:30 a.m. with 25 people raising awareness with a bridge visibility action. And then we had more than 200 people here at noon today doing an art flash mob where we got a great aerial foot image of the No Nestle sign made out of people. That'll be up online later today, and people can spread the word. The bottom line is that, you know, Oregonians don't want to see our public water resources put in plastic bottles and sold at an immense profit by a private corporation. And we definitely don't want to see that happen at the expense of threatened salmon habitat and public drinking water for our own people.
Is it the harvesting of water in general you're opposed to, or this specific proposal?
It's both. You know, water should be a public right, and we don't want to see that public resource being privatized. Considering the importance of, you know, having clean, cold, abundant water for fish, for the simple being of having water in the ground and in our rivers and streams, in addition to having access to it for public drinking water in the future as we face changes because of global warming, you know, we think it's really important that we retain and support our clean, abundant, cold water, especially that coming off of Mount Hood.
Well, who's going to decide, and what can our listeners do about it?
Right now, Nestle has, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has put forward permits to facilitate the Nestle proposal. We're asking the governor of Oregon and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to pull those permits to stop facilitating the bottling of our public water through the Nestle Corporation. There are ways to take action online. You can get that information at the Keep Nestle Out of the Gorge Coalition blog, which is keepnestleout.wordpress.com. You can also find that information at BARC's website, bark-out.org.
Those were voices from the Lower McClay Park flash mob earlier today. Nestle wants to bottle 100 million gallons of Bull Run water every year and resell it in plastic bottles at a 1,500% markup. Opponents worry about the very idea of privatizing water, especially if it harms salmon, and concern was expressed at doing business at all with a company that wanted to eradicate breast milk. To make your voice heard, call the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife at 866-942-5138 and listen at the end of the news for contact information for your elected officials. And this is Joe Meyer for I Love KBOO News.
A new study led by Oregon State University supports the idea that salmon use the Earth's magnetic field to find their way home to spawn. The results of the study were published this week in the scientific journal Current Biology. Scientists have long been studying the mechanisms of animal migration, but these results may provide the first real proof that salmon use geomagnetism to navigate. Researchers spent several months going over 56 years' worth of data on sockeye salmon returning home to the Fraser River for this study. Because the salmon had to go around Vancouver Island to get to the Fraser River, different routes could be studied. An analysis of the data showed that the number of sockeye that took the northern or southern routes home varied from year to year depending on changes in the Earth's magnetic field. Nathan Putnam, one of the authors of the study, indicated that geomagnetism might be responsible for the migration patterns of many different animals, but this is the first time that there's evidence for any of them. Putnam and his colleagues are preparing follow-up experiments at the Oregon Hatchery Research Center.
The newest document released in the Pacific Northwest grand jury case reveals that the federal government has targeted and criminalized people for being anarchists. On January 30th, a redacted affidavit was unsealed by order of Judge Richard Jones. Throughout the document, an FBI special agent assigned to the Joint Terrorism Task Force repeatedly refers to individuals under investigation as being, quote, known anarchists, end quote, and implies that the ideology alone is evidence of a crime. A member of the local committee against political repression spoke with KABU about the problems this poses.
Interestingly, within the document, Moran admits that many anarchists are law-abiding. Yet at the same time, he continually references to being a known anarchist as proof and evidence of being a crime in and of itself. And some of this is noted when Moran or Marin notes that several of the individuals who are being targeted were seen in front of squats in Portland, as if that had any relevance to the actual investigation, other than the fact that being at a squat is proof that someone's an anarchist, which is then consequently proof of being a criminal. So we see this as a continuation of using political ideology as proof and evidence of criminality. They're alleging that this is all about the May Day that just passed, so May Day 2012, and they said the investigation is surrounding damage that was done to the federal building in Seattle. But based on their own documentation, the anarchists, or the Oregon conspirators, as they keep referring to them in this new affidavit, these people were under surveillance before May Day, going so far as saying that the folks from Oregon were followed from Oregon to Olympia. So if they were investigating what happened in Seattle on May Day, unless they've got a time machine, it seems strange that they would have been surveilling and following anarchists in Portland as at least as far back as a few weeks before May Day, if not before that. Grand juries technically can only keep someone incarcerated so long as they believe that the incarceration is going to make the person testify at some later date. And that's what they call coercive incarceration. It's illegal for them to keep people held incarcerated punitively. And despite the number of times that the three people who are in prison right now have said that they have no inkling to be participating in this grand jury, they still remain to be held, which is a purely punitive measure.
That was a member of the local committee against political repression speaking about the ongoing Pacific Northwest federal grand jury case.
Yesterday, Portland's police chief Mike Reese defended his decision to demote former Captain Todd Wyatt instead of firing him. The Portland Police Review Board had recommended that Wyatt be fired after they determined he had lied during interviews with internal affairs investigators. Wyatt was interviewed by internal affairs about two separate issues: flashing his badge and gun at another motorist when off duty, and allegations that he improperly touched female employees. Chief Reese said he considered the Police Review Board's findings that Wyatt should be fired to be a recommendation. Reese initially demoted Wyatt from captain to lieutenant, removing him from the records division to a position supervising sex assault investigators in the detective division, until he found out that one of the women Wyatt had touched was working there. Reese told the Oregonian's editorial board that he had not originally thought that Wyatt's inappropriate touching of female employees had been of a sexual nature. Wyatt has since been moved to the chief's office to work on special projects. Chief Reese denies that he gave the 21-year department veteran a pass by not firing him. He said that demotion is serious discipline and comes with a serious pay cut. According to the chief, Wyatt has filed a notice that he will sue the city over his demotion.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tune in to hear from local organizers of the V-Day 2013 campaign to end violence against women. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is mostly sunny with temperatures just below 50 throughout the weekend.
It's 5:21. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Does the name Dirk Kempthorne mean anything to you? He was a little-known Idaho politico before becoming George W. Bush's industry-coddling Secretary of the Interior in 2006. While Dirk was not big on protecting our nation's public lands and natural resources from polluters and exploiters, he was very big on protecting the privileges of his own office. In particular, the environment in which he was expected to, excuse the crude reference, pee. It seems that the secretary's personal private office toilet had leaks, so in 2007, he had it renovated. No problem with that, except that the cost to us taxpayers was $222,000. Yes, his 10-foot by 10-foot water closet costs more to renovate than many people pay for an entire house. Good grief, is that even possible? Well, yes, if you're a former corporate executive who expects the facility to be worthy of your exalted station in life. Thanks to a Freedom of Information request, details of his palatial potty purchase have finally come to light. They include $26,000 for custom cabinetry, but he apparently thought that made sense, for he was, after all, a cabinet official. And the $689 faucet added a needed touch of elegance to a room that otherwise would merely be functional. But what took Kempthorne's throne over the top, all the way to interior design majesty, was the inclusion of a $3,500 Sub-Zero refrigerator and freezer, tucked tastefully behind wood paneling. As I think we can all agree, a latrine without a proper fridge is just another crapper. And while the bears in our national parks do indeed defecate in the woods, Dirk is no bear. This is Jim Hightower saying, to see some photos of the secretary's luxurious loo, go to WSBTV.com, then search for Kempthorne.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Affordable housing advocates in Oregon say they have two big priorities as the state's legislative session begins. One is improving the process for those going through foreclosure and asking lawmakers to fund programs that encourage home ownership. KBOO's Robin Ryan has the report in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
Oregon ranks near the bottom of the list compared with other states for housing affordability and the rate of home ownership. The state gets a D for not doing enough to help people buy and keep their homes on a new national scorecard from the Corporation of Enterprise Development. A statewide committee is working on recommendations to change that. Emily Ryman with NEDCO, a Eugene-based community development group, says the ideas include more than state funding for down payment assistance programs and education for new buyers.
What the Oregon On Homeownership Policy Committee and what NEDCO are trying to encourage is for the state to start looking ahead to the end of the foreclosure crisis and start to increase our investment in homeownership again. We know that it's good for low to moderate income families, and we know that it's good for the economy of the whole state of Oregon.
The CFED scorecard says 6 in 10 Oregon families own their homes, but that's below the national average. It says Oregon's highest housing prices are keeping homes out of reach for many, and that prices also affect renters. The foreclosure crisis is far from over, and Ryman says state lawmakers will also be asked to make changes to the foreclosure mediation process. Most are minor, but one would expand mediation to all foreclosure cases. Ryman explains that now, only non-judicial foreclosures, those that aren't in court, include mediation directly between banks and homeowners.
Some of the banks are trying to put forward the argument that we shouldn't expand the program before we fix it, but we're arguing that both can happen simultaneously, that we can get those small fixes through and we can expand access to more homeowners so that consumers are getting the help that they need as quickly as possible.
For KBOO News, this is Robin Ryan.
A new report in Alternet has found that Wall Street firms continue to profit off the housing crisis by buying up foreclosed homes, then renting them back to their former owners. The Blackstone Group is the biggest player in the new foreclosure-to-rental market. The company spent $2.5 billion last year purchasing foreclosed homes for pennies on the dollar, mainly at auctions or short sales. If banks were willing to renegotiate these inflated mortgages down to the same price they sell at auction, many homeowners would likely be able to afford their payments. Instead, homeowners get a flyer posted on their door the day after Blackstone purchases the home, offering them the opportunity to rent the home they once owned. At the same time, wealthy firms like Blackstone are able to outbid virtually everyone else on the market. In this way, according to the report, these financial companies manipulate the market on foreclosed homes, while struggling homeowners continue to be left out of the so-called recovery.
New York's annual Fashion Week on Wednesday faced protests from students against sweatshops, who took the opportunity to launch their campaign against footwear maker Adidas. The students protested the company's refusal to pay $1.8 million in legally owed severance pay to workers in Indonesia. To launch the campaign, the group decided to crash Fashion Week to compel the company to take responsibility for its sprawling global workforce. It's been almost 2 years since a subcontractor, PT Keyzone, was shut down without paying severance to its 2,800 workers, two-thirds of whom remain unemployed. In January, the union representing those workers obtained the right to intervene on their behalf. While other brands have contributed severance, Adidas is the only company that has refused to pay a single cent. As a result, workers have had to pull their kids out of school, and many are being pushed out of their homes. Adidas CEO Herbert Hainer said in January he expects this year's revenue to exceed $19.2 billion after reporting record-breaking profits for 2012.
An economic justice group in Eureka, California, says they have turned in nearly 2,700 signatures to put a 50% raise in the minimum wage before city voters. The Fair Wage folks want to increase the minimum wage from $8 to $12 per hour for large employers in the city. If the signatures are certified, the city council can choose to pass the Eureka Fair Wage Act or set a citywide election.
With the question of drone strikes in the headlines this week during John Brennan's confirmation hearing as CIA director, The Washington Post has published an article claiming that the vast majority of Americans support drone strikes. The claim is based on a survey that The Washington Post conducted last year. But another poll released yesterday by Farley Dickinson University found that a plurality of Americans think drone strikes on American citizens suspected of terrorism are illegal. How the questions are worded in each poll may account for the disparate results. The Farley Dickinson poll asks if, quote, Americans living abroad, end quote, can be legally targeted, while the Washington Post survey asked whether, quote, suspected terrorists, end quote, can be legally targeted. Robert Naiman, the policy director of Just Foreign Policy, spoke with KABU today about what's wrong with the Washington Post poll.
Most Americans don't know what the drone strike program is. And in particular, if you say we have a program targeted on terrorist leaders, that is an assertion which is in sharp dispute. According to some estimates, only 2% of the deaths in Pakistan since 2004 due to CIA drone strikes have been so-called militant leaders. 14 to 34% have been civilians, 5 to 7% have been children. So most people looking at those numbers, most Americans, I submit, would not characterize that as a program targeted at terrorist leaders. And therefore, if you ask people if they support the use of drones to target terrorist leaders, you're asking them whether they support a program that does not, in fact, exist in reality.
That was Robert Naiman, the policy director of Just Foreign Policy in Washington, D.C. Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn has halted a controversial police department proposal for camera-mounted drones. Police wanted to use the small remote-controlled aerial vehicles for hazmat and disaster response, search and rescue, crime scene examination, and perhaps other uses with court approval. Critics with privacy concerns and activists fear the aircraft could be used to collect information on protesters during demonstrations. Yesterday, in a statement, Mayor McGinn said that it was time to end the discussion so the department could focus on its resources on public safety and community building work. The city, now working under a consent decree with the U.S. Department with the United States Justice Department, has several high-profile cases involving police use of force and racial issues. Gunmen suspected to be members of an Islamist sect have shot and killed at least 9 people, mostly women, who were administering polio vaccine to children in Nigeria. The shooting incidents occurred on Friday as two health worker facilities in the northern city of Kano, where workers were preparing to administer the polio vaccine. Although no one has claimed responsibility, the Islamist group Boko Haram is believed to be behind the attack. Kano and other parts of Nigeria's predominantly Muslim north have a long history of opposition to polio vaccines. Some Muslim leaders claim it is part of a Western agenda to reduce the Muslim population by causing infertility. The distrust of vaccines was reinforced in 1996 after a drug trial by American pharmaceutical company Pfizer allegedly caused the deaths of several children in the city. The CIA's use of vaccine drives to cover espionage activities, most notably when investigating Osama bin Laden's compound in Pakistan, has also led to mistrust of health workers. Researchers say the CIA ruse led to a dramatic backlash against vaccines in the Middle East, in some cases causing villagers to chase off or attack legitimate vaccinators. The killing of the health workers is a major setback in the global battle to eliminate polio. Nigeria is one of 3 countries where the disease still regularly occurs.
A Palestinian man who launched a 100-day hunger strike last summer has been freed from Israeli prison. FSRN's Rami Al-Mughari reports.
Akram Rihawi was one of 2 Gaza prisoners.